This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. Christian nationalists are attacking these fundamental freedoms. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/NYT.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century. And that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
I think one of my primary qualifications to be president of the United States is that I actually do not socialize very easily. By that, what I mean is I don't take myself that seriously. I don't stand on ceremony. I don't think I'm better than anyone. And I think that's the kind of leader we need right now.
Hi, I'm Katie Kingsbury from the New York Times editorial board. And welcome to The Choice, a new podcast that brings you behind closed doors and into the exclusive deliberations process around the New York Times pick for the 2020 presidential candidate. In each episode, you'll hear Democratic presidential candidates make their pitch as they interview for the biggest job of their career. Every election year, the board chooses a candidate after closed-door, off-the-record interviews and a lot of internal debate. But the stakes are so high in 2020, and we think voters deserve to hear how we decided on our pick as the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. So we're giving you access to these conversations and the debates that followed so you can make the choice for yourself. To learn more about how the board works and who's on it, go back and listen to episode one of this series. We've trimmed each of these interviews down, but if you'd like to read the full transcript, you can find them on nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S.
Hello, everyone. Good morning.
Hello,
I'm Andrew.
Hey.
Andrew Yang was the third candidate to visit the board and the first to ride his bike to the interview.
First, we wanted to ask, were you wearing a helmet while you were biking here?
I was wearing a helmet. I have a staffer with the helmet as proof.
Since announcing his campaign for president in February 2018, Mr. Yang has gone from fringe candidate to developing a substantial following, often referred to as the Yang Gang. Despite having no prior government or military experience, Mr. Yang uses his time working in Silicon Valley and leading his nonprofit, Venture for America, to connect with potential voters on his signature issue, a universal basic income program which would provide every American with $1,000 a month. While we wanted to avoid asking too many questions about a candidate's main talking point, especially one as harped on as Yang's UBI, we still had a lot of questions about it and his plans for his first 100 days in office.
You know, your campaign platform, you have tons and tons of proposals, everything from UBI to universal daylight savings time. So plans don't really mean anything unless you have priorities. What would you do immediately when you entered office? What would be first on your agenda? What would you want to accomplish in the first 100 days?
To me, the economic imbalances are causing many of our other problems. If you look up and down the line, health problems, poor educational attainment and results, even political polarization, they stem from the fact that we have this pervasive financial insecurity where 78% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. Almost half can't afford an unexpected $400 or $500 bill. If you can't pay next month's rent, it's very hard to worry about climate change. I come and talk to you and say, hey, we need to fight climate change. And you look up and say, like, I'm worried about next month. Like, next year, next decade has to wait in line. And that's probably a generous response. I mean, some of the responses would be worse than that. So if you get the boot off of people's throats, then you can start making progress on our health, on our educational outcomes. on our political polarization. And everyone knows my flagship proposal is this freedom dividend of $1,000 a month for every American adult, which is not a new idea and it's not my idea. Thomas Paine was for it at the founding of the country. Martin Luther King fought for it and was fighting for it when he was assassinated. And so after I'm the nominee and I defeat Donald Trump, everyone will know that I'm in the White House because of the freedom dividend. Democrats and progressives will be so thrilled to have defeated Donald Trump. They will love the fact that we're going to put buying power into families' hands to make children stronger and healthier. But here's the great thing. The Republicans will look up and say, wait a minute, do I hate the freedom dividend? And they notice only one state's had a dividend for almost 40 years, and it's Alaska, a deep red conservative state. It was passed by a Republican governor. The reason why I am drawing, in some polls, 10% or more of Donald Trump voters to my campaign is that Republicans and conservatives do not hate economic buying power in citizens' hands. What they hate is a giant bureaucracy making everyone's decisions. So you ask what my main priority will be as president, it will be to get the freedom dividend across the finish line and get buying power into Americans' hands, which will then lead us to be able to solve many other problems much more quickly.
Your proposal is oddly regressive. On the benefit side, you're proposing that people will have to choose between this benefit and their existing federal benefits, while someone like me just all of a sudden gets a new check in their mailbox every month. On the funding side, you're relying on a VAT, which is an inherently regressive funding mechanism. You've proposed some offsets, but I still don't understand why you don't just embrace a progressive approach to taxation, either raise top rates or a wealth tax. If there are people who need help, why aren't you trying to help them as much as possible?
I'm for a more progressive tax structure. It's clear that the people at the top of the income chain are not paying enough. I don't think a wealth tax will work. I like the spirit of a wealth tax. But if you look at other countries' experience, Germany, France, Denmark, Sweden, very sophisticated developed countries, they tried a wealth tax and they wound up repealing it because it had massive compliance problems and it did not generate anywhere near the revenue that was projected. So if you cannot learn from the experiences of other countries, what can you learn from? We have to take a policy that actually works. And what those countries and every other developed country have determined works is a value-added tax. Because a value-added tax is impossible to game your way out of. If you're a trillion-dollar tech company, you know, I was just in New Hampshire campaigning yesterday, and you know what I say to them? I say to everyone around the country, Amazon, trillion-dollar tech company, sucking up $20 billion in business every year, closing 30% of your stores and malls, paying zero in taxes. How do you feel about that? You know, and they are angry. They say, how the heck can Amazon be paying zero in taxes? And I was like, I know. And it's up to you, the people of New Hampshire, to change it. So if you look at other countries, they have a value-added tax, and then they take those resources and put them to work towards various social programs and ways to balance out the inequality. Now, another thing I love about the value-added tax is you can either reduce it or exempt things like diapers, toilet paper, eggs, milk, things that Americans consume just to make ends meet. And you can dial it up on things like artificial intelligence, yachts, luxury watches. There are ways that you can make it so that the VAT falls more heavily on people that would barely notice. And we're taking the resources plus an additional hundreds of billions of dollars and putting it directly into the hands of working Americans. This would increase the buying power of literally 90% of Americans.
But just to be clear, it's still not a progressive tax. There's no model that says that you can use these types of exclusions and exemptions to make a VAT progressive. You can make it less regressive. You're still fundamentally proposing a non-progressive means of revenue raising.
In a vacuum, you're 100% correct. But it's failing to account for the fact that we're taking that money and then some and putting it directly into the hands of the American consumer.
But that just brings us to the other side of it, where what you're proposing is not to give as much more money to the people who need it most. You're saying if you get food stamps, the amount by which your government benefits increase will be less than for me or you.
Well, let's say I'm on food stamps and I've got a 15-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter, and I'm concerned about their future very, very deeply. And then Andrew Yang becomes president, and I find out that my 15-year-old's going to get $1,000 a month starting at age 18 for the rest of their lives, and my 12-year-old's going to get $1,000 a month for the rest of her life, I'm going to say, wow, like that's actually the biggest value gain I've ever even heard of in history. My kid will have a financial literacy class in high school, the first semester of their senior year. It is impossible to teach financial literacy to someone who does not have money.
So the kids will actually learn about what to do with the money before they start getting the money. Like, this is a game changer for Americans in any circumstance. And I am not for reducing or curtailing any of these social programs. To me, we're trying to lay a foundation that works for all Americans, and then we need to keep building on top of it. So if there are people that post the freedom dividend need additional programs and assistance, I'm all for it.
Have you spoken to Republican lawmakers about the freedom dividend?
I haven't sat down with a lot of the sitting senators and congressmen and women, but I've talked to literally thousands of people who supported Donald Trump in the last election who say they are now supporting me. And I've talked to many folks who are Republicans who say they are at least sympathetic to my message, in large part because they understand the numbers. When I spoke to 70 CEOs here in New York City, not that far from here, it's like, it's a fancy bank office. Most of them are Republicans. And I said, how many of you are looking at replacing your back office clerical workers with artificial intelligence and software? Guess how many hands went up out of 70? All of them. The truth is, you could fire any CEO who is not looking to make that happen because their incentives are all tied to the bottom line profitability of their firm. And most of them were Republicans. So they understand the need for what I'm proposing. Jamie Dimon, who is a Democrat but is a numbers person, has looked at the numbers and said, we should declare a national emergency around the fact that the economy is not working for most Americans. And he's proposing a negative income tax, which is a close cousin to the freedom dividend that I'm championing. So this is not a left or right idea. This is bipartisan. And many Republicans will see that this is going to be a huge win for their constituents, for rural areas, for red states on the interior. We don't need 80% of Congress to pass it. We just need a majority.
Neither of those is correct. You need 60% of the Senate currently. The question is, how do you plan, even if you had a Democratic majority in the Senate, which I think is right now less than even chances, how do you propose getting your agenda through Congress when the filibuster is in place?
I think we should examine the filibuster. I think that gridlock is bad for anyone trying to get anything done and solve problems. This might be controversial in this room. I am for the restoration of earmarks because it helped make legislation possible that if I was the congressperson in a district and there was a bill being passed, it's like, hey, at least I can get some pork for my local museum. And that's a very small price to pay for a functional legislature. So getting past the filibuster to me is one possible necessity, and the restoration of earmarks could be another.
So a Republican would say the alternative is to let markets work. You don't think the market will create enough jobs for Americans?
Oh, I think the market will work beautifully toward what it's designed to do. The market is designed for maximal capital efficiency, and it is doing a phenomenal job. That's why you see the returns on capital outstripping the returns on labor at historic levels. The market is not designed to maximize human well-being. And again, all you have to do to look at it is to say, stock market prices and GDP record highs, life expectancy declining. Like, that sums it up. You know, you don't need any clearer divergence than that. What I'm suggesting is we actually make capitalism's goals align with ours as human beings, as parents, as Americans. Instead of maximizing these capital efficiency measurements, we should be maximizing our own health and life expectancy, our children's education and success rates, our mental health and freedom from substance abuse, our environmental sustainability. Then we can line up the power of the markets with how we are doing. But the markets do not care one whit about us and our children.
There are some people who would suggest that a better use of money instead of giving a freedom dividend would be to dramatically overhaul America's high schools and start teaching people different skills instead of kind of trying to continue the race against AI. Like, why isn't that a path? Like, why couldn't we instead, you know, change how we do education in this country?
We should definitely do that in a very big and dramatic way. And I have proposals to help move us towards a better model of high school education. Only 6% of American high school students are in technical, trade, or apprenticeship tracks. In Germany, that's 59%. Think about that gulf. Meanwhile, there are millions of those trade and middle skill jobs that are left unfilled.
Why is this? One, it's a lot easier and cheaper for us to throw kids into a classroom with the textbooks and a teacher and say you're going to go to college than it is to try and train them in skills that are going to give them a secure livelihood. Number two, we have fetishized college and stigmatized anything that's not college. We've beaten Americans over the head, pretended everyone's going to go to college, and say it's going to work for you. And the Democrats are guilty of this. Like, that's why they're yelling, free college, free college. Meanwhile, again, only 33% of Americans are going to go to college, and that is a relatively stable number.
Access to college is still a civil rights issue in this country.
It very much is. But if you were to apply resources, you would want to apply resources in ways that don't necessarily advantage the top third of your population by educational attainment exclusively. You would be trying to build more paths for the other two-thirds, which investing in trades and apprenticeships would do. And you would try and provide for the people who are the weakest and most vulnerable in the job market, which are not going to be the people that are attending college. Our economy is breaking down on all levels. Again, if you are fortunate enough to graduate from college today, you're in the top third of the population, you're graduating with tens of thousands in school loans very, very often, and there's a 40 to 44% chance you're going to do a job that does not require your college degree. That's if you're one of the winners in our society today.
I want to ask you, you are the CEO of Manhattan Prep. How does test prep, doesn't that contribute to income inequality in the United States?
Yeah, it does. We originated the SAT during World War II as a way to determine which kids we did not want to send to the front lines. Now we treat our kids like every year is wartime. And, you know, I've talked to parents and teachers around the country, and I've said, we need to de-emphasize these standardized tests. They are a terrible measurement of human value, certainly have nothing to do with character. At this point, as you said, they are more likely to test your parents' socioeconomic status than anything else. So we need to have better, more holistic ways of measuring how our kids are doing educationally. And we need to empower teachers and let teachers do their jobs. Because if you're a teacher and you're teaching to the test, you end up making decisions in the classroom that you know are not right for the students.
More from our interview after a quick break.
Over the last 25 years, the world has witnessed incredible progress, from dial-up modems to 5G connectivity, from massive PC towers to AI-enabled microchips. Innovators are rethinking possibilities every day. Through it all, Invesco's QQQ ETF has provided investors access to the world of innovation. Be a part of the next 25 years of new ideas by supporting the fund that gives you access to innovative companies. Invesco QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. There are risks when investing in ETFs, including possible loss of money. ETFs' risks are similar to those of stocks. Investments in the tech sector are subject to greater risk and more volatility than more diversified investments. Before investing, carefully read and consider fund investment objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in prospectus at Invesco.com. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice. Moving the conversation out of schools and into the workplace, we wanted Mr. Yang's take on how the federal government could compete with Silicon Valley to attract young talent.
A couple of months ago, the general counsel for the NSA wrote an op-ed for us and was worried about this big challenge of the government not being able to acquire the tech talent. The Silicon Valley is actually, you know, so much more attractive, so much more interesting there, and that when you're looking at 5G technology, quantum computing technology, AI, not having engineers in that space and sort of outsourcing that to the private sector is potentially incredibly dangerous. Like, how do you actually make people want to come and bring that engineering talent to the federal government?
So the clearest emblem of this is NASA and space travel, where we have all watched the Apollo 13 movies and we've seen the armies of research scientists like helping launch these missions. Now, where are those researcher scientists? They're all at SpaceX and Blue Origin, and they're working for the tech guys who are putting billions into it. It's going to be very, very difficult to somehow reverse essentially decades of talent migration into the private sector. And if you're a talented kid out of Stanford, why would you work for the federal government? If you're working in the private sector,
you feel like you're going to go faster, you're certainly going to get paid more, you're going to be working with smarter people, and you idolize Elon Musk. Like, who the heck, you know, like...
That's literally our question.
Yeah. And I will say on a personal level, I spent 7 years recruiting some of our top educational products to Detroit, Cleveland, Birmingham, St. Louis. So I have seen that essentially the tide has turned in the direction it's gone, and we should not be relying upon the government as the primary employer of a lot of this tech talent. We have to face facts and say, at this point, most of the intellectual capital is being attracted to these private firms, and we need to instead try and support and work with the private firms.
Well, what about when it comes to, like, you know, the NSA and the technology they have and you know, the surveillance? Like, you don't want Google doing, you know, surveillance of people, you know, here and abroad.
Any more than they already are.
But, you know, doing it in a national security sense. Or do you?
The question is, what trade-offs are you willing to make, really? Like, the NSA is going to be able to recruit the tech talent that it can recruit, and you want to try and ramp that up. So one
thing
that...
worried about it.
They should be. I mean, clearly, because, like, you know, if you spend time on these campuses, like, you know where they're going. So one thing you can do that's very, very fast and immediate is you can become much more flexible in terms of compensation and type of work environment. So if you had, for example, a rule that said, look, the government is allowed to match whatever salary a private sector employee is being offered, then you'd have more success. If you said, look, you don't need to move to Washington, D.C. and sit in the building that was built decades ago that's like soulless and you have this giant, you know, parking lot and you just feel miserable being there for like a day, let alone a career. We also saw this happen even with the rollout of healthcare.gov. Remember this? Yeah, it's like they had the consultant and then they totally botched it. And it's not just the bleeding edge NSA type stuff. It's like if you look around congressional offices or the IRS, like they're all using technology from the, you know, like 90s or whatever it is. I had a whiz kid who said he got yelled at for writing a script in a congressional office that like automated a task. Like they were like, no, we just wanted you to do it manually forever. So there needs to be a massive modernization effort, not just in terms of how we recruit tech talent at the highest levels, but how we function even in the basics.
What we have to do is we have to home in on the specific problems we're trying to solve and use 21st century solutions for 21st century problems. Using a 20th century antitrust framework will not work. We need new solutions and a new toolkit.
You said that Senator Warren's taking sort of a 20th century antitrust framework to big tech. What does a 21st century framework look like?
The 21st century framework, first, you don't use price as your primary determinant of whether or not there are antitrust problems, because the tech companies say, what? We would never gouge anyone. It's free. We're underselling everyone. So that you have to get rid of. And that's not something she's advocating. But what she is advocating, which I find to be a bit backward-looking, is thinking that competition is the answer in these spaces. And competition misses the point in one way and another way. So let me explain. I'm a parent. I regularly challenge my kids. I say, what's more important, people or screens? And then they know the right answer is people. And then if they say screens, then I hold them upside down until they say people, people. And the people that are most diligent about screen time are the tech folks in Silicon Valley. Like, you go there, and all of a sudden, there's, like, not a screen to be had. Because they know that we have the smartest engineers in the country turning supercomputers into dopamine delivery devices for kids, because that's how they make their millions of dollars. So if that's your problem, and you break Facebook into Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, does that somehow make the kids stronger or healthier? No. If anything, it actually ratchets up the incentives to try and, like further their engagement. So if that's your problem, you have to go and try and solve it directly by getting into the guts of the apps and say, what are the design choices you made? And let's calibrate them so that they actually balance our kids' health and not just your financial returns. So that's one way she's missing the point. The other way is that many of these competitive markets end up very quickly accelerating towards one or two winners, and saying, I'm going to break you up does not solve that problem. I joke that it would be cruel and unusual punishment to say you have to use the fourth best navigation app. like, what is that? Apple Maps? Like, we all hate Apple Maps, right? Like, if you use that thing, you're like, oh, like, you know, you curse the gods until you figure out how to get Google Maps going. So going up and saying, look, you're the winner in the space, we're going to break you up, it doesn't revive Main Street businesses, and it doesn't actually end up solving the competition problem. If you want to solve the hyper-acquisition problem, which is a problem, then you have to go in and say, look, you have to not acquire businesses that are in your space with these criteria. Like, that would be a legitimate stance to take. Because right now, the business model in Silicon Valley is not to try and outcompete the behemoths. It's just to get bought by them. If you get to a point where they'll offer you $1 billion and you win, your investors win, you're rich, and then they just get folded in, and it doesn't even matter what they do with your business at that point.
You've expressed a profound distrust of market forces. You just compared the major tech companies to drug dealers, and you want the NSA to outsource national security work to them?
I do not want the NSA to outsource national security work to them. I want them to try and fight fire with fire and actually recruit using some of the same methods. And I want the NSA to try and work with them to the extent that they're realistic and they know that Google is going to be innovating in ways that the NSA will not be able to do.
There's an issue of power here. You might not be able to address the product of Facebook, you know, if you break it up from Instagram, and I understand that, and they're still going to be addictive products. But there's an issue of, like, the consolidation of actual power, the ability to buy those companies, to make those acquisitions, and just simply, like, the leverage that Mark Zuckerberg can use to have a meeting with Donald Trump, you know, that they won't tell us about. If you don't break them up, how do you get rid of that conglomeration of power?
I mean, is there still a role for 20th century antitrust?
Yes. And so all of this is a prelude to say that should some of the tech companies be asked to divest parts of their businesses? 100% yes. Like, Amazon should not be selling its own house brand Advantage to other goods. And these companies do have excessive power and influence. At this point, you could argue they control our democracy. The government is like this flopping appendage behind a lot of this stuff. I mean, honestly, like, the Office of Technology Assessment was eliminated in 1995. So our legislature is literally 24 years behind the curve on technology. And they don't understand. They're totally outgunned. They don't know what's going on. So you definitely need to bring the tech companies to heel and say, look, here are the list of problems we're concerned about. But the solution to the abuse of power is not to say, like, hey, we're just going to try and keep anyone from in the country from having the ability to do wrong. What you have to do is you have to figure out what the abuses you're concerned about are and then actually address them directly.
Who else besides you that you're running against understands the internet?
You know, I haven't hung out with enough of them to know, but I'm going to say I do not have confidence that any of my opponents get the internet.
I think it's clear that people are responding to you in part because you have this big vision. But Washington has a problem achieving even kind of modest
visions.
Yeah,
we noticed.
So, and we are currently enjoying a businessman president who has no experience in government or the military. What is your argument to people that we should trust you with no experience in government or the military in the same position and that you will do a better job dealing with the peculiarities of Washington?
First, any person who says they're going to run government like a business does not know what they're talking about because they are two completely different things. In a business, you can say, hey, we're going to go this way, and people generally have to do what you're saying. In government, it's much more analogous to my role as the founder of a national nonprofit where you have hundreds or even thousands of stakeholders, and you have to try and generate energy around a vision, let people see that it's in their self-interest or the self-interest of the people that they represent to get on board with your vision and that you're willing to compromise and work with them. That is the way I would lead as president. Donald Trump does not speak for every non-politician or non-military officer, but there is a deep need, and you've seen this. The DC establishment will not generate big solutions. One of the reasons why Donald Trump is our president is that millions of Americans feel like our government is unresponsive to our needs and the needs in our communities. They've been casting about for some sort of change agent for years. And it's not just Donald Trump's victory. It was Bernie Sanders' outsized success. In some ways, it was even Barack Obama's victory in 2008. Like, if you remember that campaign, like, it was hope, change. Like, it was not get the most experienced person in the seat as possible because we are decades behind the curve in addressing the problems and challenges that are tearing us apart.
Can I pose a future hypothetical? If the Chinese government were to flood Hong Kong with the military troops after you were president and impose a violent crackdown similar to, say, Tiananmen Square in 1989, what would you do?
I have family in Hong Kong. I spent a semester there in college. And so when I see those streets racked with riots and violence, I actually remember being on those streets. And so it's incredibly jarring. And it's an extraordinary situation because of Hong Kong's status as this semi-autonomous region that's being reintegrated back into China. Our best path forward with China is to try and have them continue to show restraint, but also see that the costs to human rights abuses, not just in Hong Kong, but with their ethnic minorities and the Muslim population, the Uyghurs, that the costs are higher than their perceived benefits of maintaining social order and stability. In order to have those costs feel real to the Chinese, we can't just moralize and say, hey, do the right thing, because at this point they're looking at us and saying, like, you know, keep your opinions and value statements to yourselves. We have to be working towards China's second main priority, which is maintaining robust economic growth. So there are two goals, their two primary goals are sometimes in tension of maintaining social order and maintaining robust economic growth. And the best way we can try and contain their behavior in Hong Kong is to say, look, the economic costs are going to be very, very high. And the best way we can do that is to build global consensus around certain norms and behaviors. At the last debate, I proposed a World Data Organization because, to me, China's in position to leapfrog us in artificial intelligence. They're investing tens of billions in a way that our government is not. It's a national effort. And they've now separated their technology ecosystem from the West's. And they're trying to sell their software and operating systems to other countries with very limited success right now. But this parallel tech universe, to me, is something that we can actually use to bring China back to the table. That's why something like World Data Organization is so vital. When they had to join the WTO, they realized this was going to be vital to their economic growth, so they're going to have to make some decisions and compromises in order to join the world order. We can create an analogous situation for data and technology and then use that to try and curb some of their worst abuses and behaviors. Now, is this going to happen in time to help Hong Kong? I certainly hope so. I mean, I certainly hope that they don't flood the streets of Hong Kong with troops anytime in the next number of days or weeks.
Do you think President Xi is a dictator?
I think he meets just about every conventional definition of dictator, yes.
I wanted to ask you about reproductive rights as well. You told some of our colleagues in the newsroom that you would consider some executive actions to protect reproductive rights, but I haven't seen any details about what actions you're considering. Do you have any details to share with us about that?
I'm all about trying to improve the reality on the ground. So the extent that we can actually put resources and funds to work in communities to make sure that women have access to reproductive rights in clinics, certainly any way we can make sure that there aren't any obstacles to the funding of Planned Parenthood clinics around the country, I would take those actions immediately. A lot of the legislative actions, you need a bit more time and a bit more buy-in from Congress. But at the Supreme Court level, I would consider appointing more justices if it was necessary to safeguard women's reproductive rights.
You mean you would, in addition to the 9 that we already have?
In addition to the 9 we already have. So if you look at the Constitution, there is nothing there that stipulates the number of Supreme Court justices. We've had fewer than 9. We've had more than 9. I think that appointing new justices would be helpful on several levels. It would help depoliticize the process, at least marginally, because if you have 17 justices and one steps down, then it's not as much of an earthquake. But right now, we're hinging our laws on the health of an octogenarian. It would literally be rational for us all just to follow Ruth Bader Ginsburg around and just, like, scrub any doorknob she touches.
So can you give us some names of people you would nominate to the Supreme Court?
that's a fun exercise. I haven't gotten into the judicial appointment shortlist yet, but safeguarding women's reproductive rights would be one clear criteria, because women's reproductive rights are fundamental human rights in my mind. I think it's actually unfortunate that I get asked about those sorts of questions in the sense that I feel like men should just leave the room and let women decide what to do with your bodies. I have a feeling I know what you would decide, and then we could come back and say, hey, what did you decide? I also think that if men got pregnant, this would be a very, very different conversation, and you know, we'd have like a completely different different approach to these issues. So you need to modernize the court. Lifetime appointments might have made sense at one point a long time ago, but when the Constitution was drafted, people did not live as long. And also, people stepped down from the Supreme Court for any of a range of reasons. They did not wait until they were at death's door. This is not a way to run a 21st century society. We should have 18-year term limits, increase the number of justices, make it so it's predictable that you lose an election, the other party might get one or two justices, and then we don't need to literally be monitoring the health of our justices. Or, like, the most ridiculous thing is you're literally, like, looking at the age of the person you're appointing, being like, ooh, this person will be there for, like, 30, 40 years. Like, what kind of system do you want where you're having a society decide 30 years ago what women's rights are today?
Are you concerned that you wouldn't be triggering a back and forth between Republicans and Democrats who are continuing to add justices to the bench with each new administration to satisfy their own policy priorities?
If you have term limits, it is bipartisan.
Back in September, you actually spoke out on behalf of the comedian Shane Gillis, who had been hired on SNL and then was quickly fired after some racist comments were stirred up that he had made in the past on one of his podcasts. And you said you didn't want to be judged for something you had done 25 years ago. But Gillis's comments were from maybe a year ago. So I'm curious as to, in your mind, like, how long of a period of time should someone, like, should it be before someone faces some sort of consequences for something they've done in the past?
So when I heard that Shane Gillis had called me Jew chink, I think was the slur, my reaction was the same reaction anyone would have, which was like, who the heck is this guy? And he sounds like a total jackass. And so then I sat down and started to figure out who Shane Gillis was, what he did for a living. And then I sat down and watched some of his comedy to try and get some context. And after watching his comedy, I felt that he wasn't a malignant racist and that his slur towards me was just very, very bad comedy run amok, which did not strike me as a fireable offense. And I realized that if I was the individual who was actually directly slurred and I did not feel that he should lose his job over it, then I should probably share that sentiment with other people, particularly because I think we've become unduly vindictive and punitive towards statements that people find objectionable. The comment about I wouldn't want to be judged for something 25 years ago was about something completely independent. I think I'd seen something where Joe Biden was being called out for something he'd said 25 years ago, and I said, like, I wouldn't want to be called out for some misstatement I made 25 years ago, and then I joked, good thing no one cared about what I was doing 25 years ago because I was, at that point, you know, a 20-year-old man, and the internet didn't really have full documentation of how I spent those years. So the Shane Gillis opinion was not based upon the time lag. It was just based upon my reaction as a person and the person that was directly named.
I mean, he's never truly apologized. He just said, you know, I'm sorry you're offended. And while you may not have felt that way, there were other jokes he made about just Asian Americans and Asian people in general. And there are other people who were obviously affected by this. So, I mean, what kind of consequences do you think someone who makes those kind of statements and who doesn't show any sort of remorse for it should they face? If not firing, like, what should happen? What would the steps be?
I'd suggest that to the extent there are consequences for people's misstatements, they should be somewhere, like, commensurate to the level of power and influence they have and the harm that they're doing. In Shane Gillis's case, like, I'm Asian American, like, I had never heard of the guy before the statements had taken place. In terms of consequences, I would suggest that someone like Shane had probably paid a price in many ways. Like, aside from being fired, you know, there are many circles that if he shows up in, like, he'd be labeled very, very negatively. He reached out to me personally, and I had a conversation with him. And the conversation with him made me feel more confident that I'd done the right thing. Because I think in many cases, we're trying to follow up on a sense of shame and humiliation that the person might already feel.
We wanted to ask the candidates questions they'd never heard on the trail, to throw them off their game a bit and get a sense of who they are as people outside of their prepared talking points. Mr. Yang loved it.
So I want to move on. We have some more personal questions for you. I
think really?
Mara's going to kick you off.
If you become president, what government secret are you most excited to learn about?
Definitely aliens, of course. That'd be my first question. I got in there, I'd be like, all right, let me see them. Let's see what we've been hiding all of these years.
Who has broken your heart?
Wow, these questions are really fun. Who's broken my heart?
Don't be tactical now.
This is going to make me very sad to say, but I feel like I had an arc or a relationship with President Obama where it was inspirational when he won. I was celebrating with my wife in the streets. And then over the years, I began to feel like we'd missed a great opportunity. I think that he did a lot of great things and he did a lot of what he could. But to the extent that there was a missed opportunity, it was in the wake of the financial crisis. And it's very hard to Monday morning quarterback a team when they literally felt like the economy itself was at stake. But we should have done much more to recapitalize homeowners as opposed to the banks. So that, to me, was the biggest missed opportunity in the Obama administration. It happened very, very early on. I wish that they owned and reflected a little bit on the fact that maybe they could have done some things differently at that stage.
When was the last time you rode the subway?
I rode the subway maybe 6 weeks ago or so. It's become much more of a pain in the neck now that I actually get recognized. I confess that that's been the biggest adjustment in running for president because I was like, no, I'm not going to get recognized on the street. Of course, keep in mind, I mean, when I started my run, I was completely anonymous. I mean, none of you had ever heard of me. Also, there is, and this is not to make too much of it, but there's also like this invisible Asian man thing that you feel like all you have to do is just like, you know, not want to be seen and then you disappear. And that doesn't work anymore. And so when I'm on the subway, like people will look at me and then look and look at me. And then eventually someone will inch over and say like, hey, you running for president? And then I'll say, yes, I am. They're like, hey, I like you. $1,000 a month, something like that. And then want to take pictures, and then as soon as someone breaks the seal, then it's safe for everyone to do it. And so then, like, I'll be, and then there's this uncomfortable period in the subway car after right. You've taken the pictures with them, you're still sitting there. And so then they're like, so, you know, like, where are you going, or how's Bernie, or whatever the heck questions are. So I have not been riding the subway lately, but I've ridden the subway an awful lot over really the years. Now my preferred mode of transportation is the bike because if someone recognizes me, it's generally too late.
What are you likely to fail at as president?
I will fail at many things, I'm sure. Keep in mind, I am married, so I understand my daily
You're
failures.
Failing.
One thing I've learned even as a candidate that I've struggled with, truthfully, is that an entire organization hinges upon like your day-to-day decisions or movements. And I know as president, that will be amplified to a very, very high level. I like being a relatively normal citizen. I like being able to go to places and find things out and have like normal conversations. I think that's going to be a real challenge for me because I've seen even now, people are more likely to tell you positive things or things you want to hear. Than the bad stuff. And so I think it's going to be a challenge for me to understand what's happening behind the smiling faces and the people at work for me and my administration. So I need to find ways to overcome that challenge. I'm feeling it even now because I am a lay person who decided to run for president and that there have been many transitions on a personal level. I think one of my primary qualifications to be president of the United States is that I actually do not socialize very easily. By that, what I mean is I don't take myself that seriously. I don't stand on ceremony. I don't think I'm better than anyone. And I think that's the kind of leader we need right now.
All right. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you all.
That was the majority of the editorial board's interview with Andrew Yang. To To read the entire conversation, visit nytimes.com/endorsements. That's endorsements with an S. To hear what the board had to say after Mr. Yang's visit and a deeper dive into the candidate's appeal to young people, check out the Deliberations episode, also released today. Join us back here tomorrow for a conversation with Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. See you there. The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board, right? Because in Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing board or Miro board?
Drawing board, because, you know, in Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course, present my thoughts the way I want.
Right again! Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is! Drawing board or...
Miro! All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
Join over 60 million people getting ideas noticed in Miro Brainstorms. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.